here. So what'd you have for breakfast this morning?
Had coffee for breakfast. Coffee and more coffee.
Okay, let's see. Let me,
and a hike.
And a hike, okay. Is that, am I even turning the right thing? Yeah. Let's see. Well, it looks like it's...
Is that one of those real sensitive mics?
Yeah, it's pretty sensitive. Okay. Let's see, I'm going to pause it. Okay. All right. This is Chip Nold. I'm interviewing Mike Bacayu in the basement of his home in Fern Creek. And we're going to talk now about his life and times. Okay, so when and where were you born?
I was born in North Dakota, Fargo, North Dakota, June of 1967.
Okay.
The same, same week that Sgt. Pepper's was released.
Okay. So when did y'all come to Louisville?
Dad was in training for doing his residency to be a doctor. So we moved from Fargo to Baltimore, where he went to Johns Hopkins. And then I believe what happened was he got his citizenship after 8 years or something. He and Mom did. And the second he became a citizen, he got drafted. So they needed physicians, so we got stationed at the Naval Base in Philadelphia and stayed there a couple years, and then moved outside of Philadelphia to Pottstown, the birthplace of Daryl Hall.
Okay.
And Kiwi Shoe Polish is from there. And then moved here in 74 after the tornado.
Okay, so you were seven, I guess?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right. And where in Louisville did you live?
Lived off of Brownsboro Road and Watterson. So it was called Winding Falls, but it's now part of Indian Hills.
Okay. All right. And so you said your dad became a citizen and your mom, were they both born in the Philippines?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
All so right. We're first, my sister and brother, first generation Bacayu.
Okay. All right.
In America.
Okay. And so then your father was a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Did your mom work? Or
She was a registered nurse until she had us. So it'd probably been easier to be a nurse than raising us.
Okay. So just how did you first get interested in music? What are your early memories of listening to and playing music?
I tell this to people all the time. My mom was saying, she was so adamant about us learning how to play piano and violin. And I assumed that she played too, that her parents made her learn how to play that stuff. And later on, of course, I found out she couldn't play anything. But she got us started, I don't know, maybe when we were like four, playing piano and then into the violin.
Okay.
And kept up with that. Like, I guess my first band was the Louisville Youth Orchestra.
Okay.
The first time I played with a group of any sort. And I was played with them, I think, if I remember correctly, I may have been first chair, second violin, and my sister was first chair, first violin. And I think when we would audition to get into the youth orchestra, we'd always play duets. Okay. And that worked out well.
How long did you stay in the youth orchestra?
Probably until maybe sixth grade.
Okay. All right. So how did you get involved in the underground music scene? Or if there's a step I'm skipping, fill it in.
See, throughout grade school, or actually when we lived out in Pottstown, our next door neighbors were from England.
Okay.
And so they're huge Beatle freaks. And then...
Am I knocking
them? Oh, no, you're fine. Okay. And so turned us on to the Beatles. And I remember, even, like, my mom had some Beatles records, and I never put two and two together that Meet the Beatles was the same Beatles as the Let It Be Beatles. And incidentally, one of my first records, I think, was Ringo Starr, Year 16, with the 45 of that and Devil Woman on the other side. And then I remember going to school listening to the bus driver would always play Wings, Band on the Run. Okay. And that was kind of neat. Moving here, in grade school, there's a bunch of us that like listen to the Beatles, and we listen to all sorts of different stuff, AC/DC, Kiss, everybody was big on Kiss. And then at that time too, maybe sixth grade, Dad was going to these Filipino doctor conventions. And they'd be all like in Boston or Florida, different places. And I think at that time, some of those big city Filipinos were into New Wave and all that kind of stuff. So I think, because I was trying to remember the first time I really started listening to things like that was not rock, maybe, you know, something different like Blondie and the Cars and all that kind of stuff. And I think maybe around that time, because also being a big Beatle freak, I was buying, this probably started all my record collecting, was wanting to collect or get every Beatle record. And I had this huge fascination with Apple Records, how cool that was. So I was buying up all those records, 45s and LPs, even the 8-tracks.
Okay.
Like I've got Elephant's Memory 8-tracks. And so with that, getting some of those Yoko records, where it was just like, it was screeching, you know? But then listening to that and hearing John Lennon's guitar work was really cool. And then later on, reading about B-52s, loved Yoko Ono. And I was like, well, I got to hear B-52s.
Okay.
But I think around seventh or eighth grade is maybe when we were all kind of getting into New Wave and that kind of stuff and hanging out around the Vogue and getting in the Sex Pistols and remotely hearing about Dead Kennedys. And of course we'd start spray painting St. Matthews, like the big parking lot that was behind Bacon's.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's there anymore. No, it's not there anymore.
Right.
But we spray painted the hell out of that with all this like New Wave punk stuff. And then I think that's where I like going to the Vogue is where I first met like Irv and the Moore Twins.
Okay.
And that might have been about eighth grade. And I don't know, that all that stuff is pretty cloudy back then. And I'm trying to figure out the transition from all that into, I think some of the conventions we went to with Dad, like in Boston, I started buying some hardcore records. And even out in LA, I bought some compilations and different things. And probably the only other place around here that I was able to get to was Pyramid. And they had a bunch of, you know, punk. And they also had all the Beatle bootlegs.
Okay.
Because I'd hang out there a bunch looking for the Beatle bootlegs. And they certainly had plenty of them. And then for some unknown reason, I don't know how, Bob and Lou started ordering hardcore records and punk records. But at least they had them. And then I don't know, I'm trying to think what else there was that got me wrapped up in that kind of thing. It was probably just being a kid and going through all sorts, you know, prepubescent, getting into puberty, and you're into, your hormones are crazy, and you're just into exciting, stupid, crazy things sometimes, you know, and you're invincible. And then the music just riles you up, and nobody else listens to it, and you don't want to be like those people that just... Right. It's not trying to be different, but it's not understanding why they follow the rules.
Right.
And not that I wanted to be a rule breaker, but there's something that's exciting. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm.
Two things you mentioned, maybe you could tell me any more about or anything that you remember. The first, you talked about hanging out at the Vogue. Probably worth describing it. Just you and I both know what the Vogue was, but for history.
The Vogue. See, I think when we first started hanging out there, it might have been, I mean, actually going was probably 7th, 8th grade, and going to see some movies up there, having our folks drop us off. And then we'd see some people up there. Of course, all the Rocky Horror people up there. And then we went to Rocky Horror a few times. And then they started having, Erg the Music War. Mm. And went to that a few times. And that was like kind of mind-boggling and life-changing, too. Because we got exposed to so many different bands. XTC, I forget who else was in that, but... I mean, that was a great movie. And I finally got that on DVD. Punk rock movie.
I've never seen that.
Oh, it's unreal. Saw the decline of Western civilization there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was kind of the St. Matthew's magnet for, I guess, like-minded weirdos, you know?
Right. Yeah, and so, yeah, I mean, they'd show, it was an
it was wasn't an archive, like the showcase.
Right, yeah. Yeah, they were showing older movies or...
And not doing the mainstream thing. Yeah, like A Clockwork Orange, people always go to that. You know,
right.
That's a good place, or it's a good movie for grade school kids and young teenagers to see. You know? right. Over and over and over.
Okay, and then, tell me about Pyramid Records.
Pyramid is corner of Bonnie Castle and Bardstown, and I forget what it is now. It was on the west side of Bonnie Castle and Bardstown, mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't know how long it had been there, and it just looked like some little head shop with records, a bunch of records, and had that smell of patchouli or some kind of incense burning all the time. And it was always Bob. Every now and then you'd see Lou.
Well, do you remember their last names? I don't.
Bob Nord and Lou, I forget what. But Lou owns Electric Ladyland. I guess they both work at Electric Ladyland mm-hmm. now. But they had a band called Black Tie. I guess they did covers. And I don't know. They're interesting people. Lou was a little more out there and kind of... Bob was the more introverted kind of check out these records and real low-key.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm like trying to figure out there. I guess they're kind of pothead hippie-ish kind of stuff people, but I... couldn't understand how they had punk rock records, but thank God they did.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a particularly punk or new wave oriented atmosphere. I mean, I don't know if we ever really had a record store that...
I think it's just classic rock and what was around back then, because the punk and new wave records were so scarce anyway. That was also the place where you walk in the door and they had all those flyers. And so that could be like the advent of like people advertising their shows or people looking for people to play in their bands.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So,
So what's the first show you saw?
I don't even remember. I just remember going to Tooligan's and... I do remember Brian Hurst always kicking me out because being the only Filipino probably looked like a little 10-year-old, even though I was probably maybe 15.
Mm-hmm.
Close enough. Right. And sneaking in to see a show, I would stick out. And because I remember he had his head shaved, I think, and I'd always see that shaved head walking towards me. It's like, damn, he caught me again. And I don't know who I was with. The first show I recorded on Jambox that I remember was Squirrel Bait, Malignant Growth, and Maurice.
Okay. And,
but I think I'd gone to some shows before that, or some of those little punk parties where they had bands. And maybe 82? I don't know. 81? I don't know what years those were.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
the show I recorded, though, with that lineup of Squirrel Bait, Maurice, and Malignant Growth was maybe early 84. Could have been late 83. I'd have to see the flyer on that.
So who's in Maurice then?
It was Rat, Britt, Brian, and Ned Oldham.
Okay.
Was playing bass. Because that was, I guess, out of the ashes of Languid and Flaccid. You know, that's one of those things too. When I would see those all ages shows downtown at the Beat, Mom, can I get a ride? And it's like, no, you can't go down there. So I'd have to wait till there was convenient times where I could get to a show, because I never went to the Beat. I always just saw the flyers.
Why did she not want to take you down there?
I don't know. Maybe she had this thing about downtown, just from living in Philadelphia.
Sure.
It's like, it's not safe.
Right.
You know, we're in the burbs now, so let's just stay.
First Beat was on a very sleazy block.
Uh-huh. Wasn't it next to the porn shop?
It was a strip show. There was a strip club.
And,
yeah. I mean, all kinds of stuff. But, okay, so you never got to the all-ages shows at the Beat. And then, did Tooligans do all-ages shows?
I don't think so. I think we were just getting in there. And because I do remember the Poor Girls always playing. You know, you see their flyers everywhere. And then the occasional punk rock ones.
Okay. So then how did you start playing with Maurice? How did that happen? I'm assuming that's your first band then.
Yeah. What was it? I had, I think I put up something at Doo-Wop Shop to start a hardcore band or a punk rock band. And the person that got back with me was Gravy Dave. It was Gravy Dave. So
Dave Meyer.
Yeah.
Sorry, this is his last name. Yeah.
And Rich Knapper, Jack Boots. So they came over to my folks' house, and it's like, holy shit. Because Dave had this old beat-up car, and he had the look.
Yeah.
And I thought, luckily my folks aren't home. And we talked about stuff and ended up hanging out with them. I guess I was playing guitar and Dave was playing bass, and then Napper was playing drums and just banging around stuff. And so they'd tell me more about Malignant Growth and AYCD. And I think around that same time I'd met Wayne.
Dwayne Pyatt?
Yeah, I think his girlfriend was friends with my sister. And I don't know. from the Dave Myers thing and Napper thing. Shoot, I don't know what the transition was. But we, I think they were wanting to do something like AYCD. We may have played something at the punk house on Hepburn, that first punk house,
mm-hmm.
on Halloween. I don't even know what year that was. I think we tried to play something. It was probably a disaster. And
yeah. You said something like AYCD. What do you mean?
Because I think they had just disbanded or something. And I don't remember if they're wanting to, if Tommy, their guitar player.
Is that Tommy John?
No, or? Tommy, I forget what his name is. Okay. Tip of my tongue, but maybe he left town or something. And they wanted, I don't know why they'd want me on guitar, because back then, not that I'm a great guitar player now, but I certainly wasn't a real guitar player back then. I could do bar chords and stuff, but maybe so, because since it was all just bar chords, and it was just real simple. And that could have been when I first met Rat and all those guys, through them. Because Dave Myers, he did take me to a few parties out in the South End. And I think we'd gone to some lignin growth practices, too.
Okay.
Yeah, I do remember one time I just had my driver's permit.
Mm-hmm.
And my folks were having a party at their house. And I bugged them so much to let me take the car, even though I had my permit. And that this older Filipino buddy of mine would be the one watching me drive. So we drove out to, it might have been Dave Myers' house off Cane Run Road. And Malignant Growth played out there. It's just, and I guess that's where I was hanging out with, started hanging out with Irv and the Moore twins. There's so many bits and pieces.
So what was your impression of that?
Just more excitement, something different. It's excitement in the unknown, you know? And I guess I've always been like that, getting into things that you just never know. I mean, it could go bad. It's always a 50-50 shot. It's like, I'm just going to do it and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a bad way to go. But luckily, it's most of the time it's gone a decent way.
Yeah.
And if there's been failure, the wrong thing to do. I mean, all that stuff has made me who I am now. It's like I say, you know, it's always said that I'm the sum of all my failures, right. You know, and that's great. You know, I don't run from failure. It's like, you know, sometimes you just have to, and then you just work from there.
I guess I wonder about, you know, Louisville has this weird sort of quasi, you know, it's not exactly, some of it's segregation, but some of it's just different types of people keep to different parts of town. I was wondering, you know, was there anything, I mean, how did that strike you?
So probably like the factions, it seemed like some people might look at it like factions of the South End versus the right. East End versus the Highlands. But maybe for all of us, we were at that age where, like for me, I couldn't go out to the South End. I mean, it's too far away. And I could kind of make it to the Highlands on the bus.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't think there was any intentional kind of, like, taking sides. And I'd always been interested in all that, like, your all's music. The Babs, Malignant Growth, all that stuff. Because what we had, I mean, you know, we were trying to find those records. And here it is, you guys are, you know, where I can't go see you all or can't get any of that kind of stuff. So we had to go look for it. And I guess the meeting place was the Highlands for everybody.
Sure. And I'm not saying that it was faction. I mean, it's an interesting thing that, you know, I think lots of people met through the medium of all that.
And it's good that it was
different parts of town met.
It's different upbringings. And then it just, you know, when we all met, it was all those different experiences. And, you know, it could have expanded my experience by meeting some of those guys. Like, man, those guys are crazy as shit. They did that. It's like, well, I can kind of do that stuff too. You know, and I probably did.
Yeah.
And they knew a lot of music, and then I was buying a bunch of records. just because I was trying to find, you know, as much of this stuff as possible. And we all start trading tapes or just, you know, saying, listen to this band, or that band sucks, but I like it. Although, I mean, and I think at that time, you might agree, there was such an explosion of music that was like, wow, because reggae, ska, and all that stuff that became accessible.
Right.
And I don't know if it's, well, you know, probably partially MTV. And for me, it was going out of town with my folks and meeting these other Filipinos that were getting into this music.
Right, right. So where were you going to high school?
St. X.
Okay. Oh, is that right? Okay.
And, yeah, I ended up living at the punk house because, let me see, what year was that? I might have been sophomore or junior or something. But, I don't know if I was working or... Either way, this is a funny story. Me and a couple buddies, we thought, we'll just buy a big bag of weed and sell it and we'll have money. And so I think we bought a quarter pound and we split it up three ways. And it's like, it would have just been easier to get a job. You know, and I probably was working. I might have been working over at G.D. Ritzy's or Burger King, but just to get more money.
Right, right.
And so I was at my folks' house. I was taking a shower. Got out of the shower, drying off, and then all of a sudden, my mom throws the door open, holding my portion of the weed. Oh. And she's like, "What is this?" Screaming, "What is this?" And then she's acting like she's sniffing it, and she's like, "I'm getting high already. You wait till your daddy gets home." And I thought, oh, shit. So I just packed up my stuff. Because I could try to explain to them that I don't like that stuff. I just wanted to make money. I mean, a lot of my friends love smoking pot, and I cannot stand it. I tried and tried to like it, and I hated it. And
that's terrible. Getting busted for something you don't even like.
Yeah, but it goes back to, I could have just, you know, gotten another job.
Right, right.
But it ended up being, looking back, it was a good experience. I mean, because I think I was always in trouble with my folks anyway. Yeah. So I left home that day. I packed up a backpack, and I remember getting a can of Spam. And I thought, well, I'll just walk to this girl's house and I know she'll let me stay at her house because she'll sneak me up in her room, and her brother goes to St. X, and then I'll sneak out and we'll go to take the bus together. So I forget. I think she went to Sacred Heart. Oh, but I remember walking through Seneca Park to get to her house because she lived on Taylorsville Road, and I'd walk through St. Matthew's just walking. And I thought, I'm hungry. And I remember eating that Spam and then getting halfway through the park and thinking, I don't have any damn water. And that stuff is so salty. Yeah, that's one recollection I have of that. But got there, I stayed at her house, I guess. Her parents didn't even know I was living up in her room. I don't know, maybe a couple weeks. And then finally, I somehow ended up at the punk house, and living at that punk house was, I think, Sean Mulhall, and was it, maybe he was living there with Laura Faye, and then Dave and Wendy lived there, and then some other
Dave guy. And Wendy.
Yeah, Dave, Gravy Dave, and
oh, okay.
Wendy Watson, and I think there might have been one more person, and there's this, on the second floor, there was a big walk-in closet with a window. And I somehow ended up in there.
So you're still going to school?
Yeah, I went to school every day. Well, there's a couple times, a few times, because, I mean, we were always drinking. I mean, I was getting good grades. I mean, I think I was getting A's and B's still. I get up every morning. But there was a few times where we didn't have a phone. I'd have to go up the street. And I don't know if it was Mark was living up the street or somebody. And I'd use their phone and I'd act like my dad. This is Dr. Bakayu. My son Michael is sick today. He won't be at school. And they wouldn't question it. So I could just sit there and like, all right, cool. And at that point, my parents had totally cut me off. They said, nothing. We're not giving you any money. You know, it's your decision. You think you know so much. You stay there. Don't ask us for anything. The only thing we can do that we're obligated to do is pay for school. And if you screw that up, that's on you. Because they'd always told me how important school was anyway. And there's no way I was going to miss any school. I kind of want to thumb my nose at him that I was getting A's and B's still. And there's a liquor store up at Grinstead and Bardstown.
Right.
And
Coach Stop, I think.
And I would go up there all the time. I went up there one time because we needed beer and I got a collection of money. Went in there and I think I might have gotten a case of beer, put it up on the counter, and they're asking me, like, do you have an ID? And here it is, I'm 16 or 17. And I acted like I couldn't speak English. And then they said, how old are you? How old are you? And I finally told them, I was like, 22. And so I'd go there all the time. They were just selling me beer and booze. It worked out great, you know? So I was thinking, I must have been really fucked up at that point to be sitting there going to do that. Because they were nice as all get out. And then the last time I went up there, when the scam came about, when they realized, it was like, no. I went in there to buy more beer, and they're like, we understand you're not 22, and we can't sell to you anymore. And I tried to make that real confused, like, you know, immigrant look, like, what are you saying? So I left, and then that Monday when I went to school, my teacher pulled me out, my English teacher, and he gave me a sob story about, like, I saw what you did to those people up there at that liquor store. They're the nicest people, and I can't believe you did that. And your parents pay for this education. You do all this drunk shit, blah, blah, blah. I used to do that when I was younger. I got drunk and swam across the river. I'm lucky to be alive. And you know, what he was saying was correct. But I'm sitting there thinking, right, at that point, like, hey, I'm a teenager, you know? I that didn't affect me or anything. I mean, I was already probably gone by that point with going where I was supposed to go.
Yeah.
On that mysterious road for me. And that might have been, no. I think it was the, actually, I'm trying to get my times right. That was the first time I played with, at the Punk House, was the first time I played with Maurice. When it was me and Rat, Britt, and Brian.
So how did you get into that?
That, I don't know. And I'm glad I got into it. I think at that point, too, I don't know if I was really hanging out with... I think around the Punk House, me and Pajo were really hanging out a bunch, going to shows and stuff. And then we'd also done this little Solution Unknown thing on four-track, just Hannah, just recording stuff.
Oh, so I didn't know that. So that was even before...
Yeah, because
we're playing out Solution Unknown.
Yeah. I mean, it's just us two. And we were listening to Meat Man records. And yeah, it's very juvenile. But funny. And just fast bar chord stuff. And he had... actually, before I was hanging out with Dave a lot, I used to hang out with his older brother, Butch. But his brother, he and I used to listen to Elvis Costello and Jam and all that kind of stuff too together. And but somehow Dave and I started hanging out more. And maybe it's just he's a big headbanger, big metalhead. And I always say I introduced him to MDC, Millions of Dead Cops, let him borrow that record, and he let me borrow Metallica's Kill 'Em All.
Okay.
And so I think he got the short end of the stick, you know, because we just got, I mean, we just went crazy on that Metallica record. And then when I got into Maurice, kept on bringing Dave with me to band practice. And we'd leave practice, and I had some practice tapes, and I wish I still had them. And we'd go to his house or my house, and we'd mess around with those same songs. And when Brian decided he wanted to go, like, he wanted to play the squirrel bait, I was like, I got the guitar player. And I just remember the first time Dave practiced with us. He set up, and we went through the whole set. He knew every song. And Britt and I were laughing. Rat was on the phone. I mean, I was like, my God, this is just crazy. Because it was a lot more hardcore than with Dave in the mix. It was just like, this kind of stuff has never been heard before. I mean, this was something new, having a guitar player like Dave.
Just because he was more of a metal shredder
type
than...
Yeah, so it was like way before any kind of crossover. It was just because he might have had some of that metal stuff, but the metal licks and all that kind of stuff. But we... I don't know. It was just...
Well, I kind of supplied the answer. How... Describe it. What was it about Nobody's Heard This?
Just... A hardcore band, and Britt being like the drummer that he is, and just the combination of just all of us together at that point, it was like an explosion of organized chaos in a way. I mean, because it sounded like Britt could just completely go crazy on the drums, and Paho can go completely crazy on the guitar. You know, and then Rat screaming. It's like, yeah, I wish, I might actually have, oh, I do have some recordings and stuff. Yeah, I wish we would have been able to record something in the studio at that point, the very first, like, practices of Maurice, because that was, I don't know, incredible.
It's kind of like a discovery almost.
Yeah.
Like,
because we played a few shows with some bands, and there was this band from Italy called Raw Power, and we played a show with them, and they were like, we opened up for them. I think whenever we opened up for bands, it was just a different sound. Because I think the hardcore thing was riding high, too, like all the Misfits, Samhain, Black Flag.
Mm-hmm.
But... nobody had that Maurice sound. Nobody.
Just to backtrack a little bit, you just kind of brought Paho in. How did you know him?
They lived pretty close to us, but my folks were friends with his folks. His dad was a doctor, okay. So we'd be around the same circles.
Okay.
And so I guess he... Because he's like the middle kid, too. The middle Filipino kid syndrome.
Okay. I didn't know that was the syndrome. Okay. All right. So you start playing together with these guys, and you say, you sort of see you got something, and it's different. Talk about how it developed and, you know, where Maurice played and... all that.
If you listen to some of the early practice tapes or the live shows, and then towards, you know, when we disbanded, you're going to hear a lot of things changing. and for the better. I mean, it you can do three chords for so long,
right?
And then Britt and Dave started. I think something was wrong with Britt. His brain was getting out there, and it was awesome because he writes some of this stuff, and then this material that was off beat, and Paho would be embellishing, and they totally fed off each other, and it got to a point where it was like, with their musicianship, you know, I was just in awe. I mean, I can play decent, but those guys were like the masters, you know, and Rat and I, Sean and I, we liked Black Sabbath on speed. Those guys liked who knows what. I mean, they're drawing from musical influences everywhere, and then whatever was in their heads, because they were that musically inclined.
Right.
Me, I'm the jack of all trades, master of nothing on instruments. I can do chopsticks on the piano or something. You know, I can play the mandolin, I can play a little banjo, guitar, and all that kind of stuff. But those guys are the kings of what they play. And so that's where, you know, when we disbanded, the Ashes, Rose, Slinton, King Horse.
Right.
And I think that fit who Sean and I were, and Britt and Dave.
Right.
I mean, that was the directions we were supposed to go.
Right.
With Maurice, we got to play out of town. I wish we would have done more, but we were, you know, still teenagers. And right. It was amazing. Our folks let us go on this. We did a tour with Sam Hain. We played one show with Sam Hain at the Jockey Club, and Sean was buddies with Danzig, so... I guess he wanted a tape of us. I don't know how that all came about, but we ended up doing a mini tour with them. We played here at St. Albert the Great, which I don't know how Bart Whitehouse pulled that off. You know, a band looking like Sam Hain playing at the St. Albert's gym off Westport Road. And with all these punk rock kids. And then we played Columbus, Ohio, and played Detroit, which was really cool, cold. And then came back for a day, and then we played in Bloomington. But it was us in a van, and then our friends like John Toombs and Ken Chappelle, just Will Oldham, we all went. I mean, everybody's in different cars. I remember driving back from Detroit. And I didn't ride in the van. I was with John Toombs and Paho, and we pulled off at a rest area to sleep. And I think me and Paho woke up. I don't know what happened, but we started screaming at John, "Get up, wake up, drive, drive." And jumped his ass, and he freaked out and started driving. And it was just crazy stuff. That was the same trip, too. I think Kevin Mitchell was with us. And we were at some kind of rest area. Yeah, there was the dueling vans. There was the Sam Hain van, and then there was the Maurice van, and then there was the cars that were following us up. And I think we were throwing food at each other's vans. And then we stopped at a rest area, and we're running around the woods, and there's like this big log going across this muddy creek. And I'm thinking, yeah, I can make it across. And then we were all chickened out, and then Kevin Mitchell comes up, and he used to always wear those white jazz shoes.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, that's almost a given where this is going, but he's like, "Get the fuck out of my way, you pussies." He starts going across that log over the muddy creek and just falls in, and it's like... Yeah, I wish I would have kept a journal back then of, like, different things. I didn't think about that, you know. I mean, who thinks about that stuff?
Right.
What else? Where else did we play? We played one of our shows. We played with the Descendants down on Broadway at this bingo hall.
I remember when that happened, yeah.
And that was really neat. I'm just thinking that's like 30-some-odd years ago, 31 or 32 years ago.
Were they a pretty big band by that point? Or?
Yeah, Descendants were, yeah. And a lot of those bands were big by our standards back then.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it's not like the Misfits now being huge. It's like they're only together for X amount of time and only X amount of people really saw them.
Right.
The other thing that was going on during Maury's, Paho and I were, I guess we might have started, or I might have started going to U of L. We were hanging out with like the John Toombs and Bart Whitehouse, like some of these East End guys, these Trinity guys, Ballard guys. And we, from that Solution Unknown cassette that we had done, just for fun, you know, we had drinking buddies and stuff. We formed Solution Unknown, like the band.
Okay.
And so it was Eric Schmidt singing. He'd gone to Trinity. And then Kent Chappelle was playing bass. Paho was on drums and I played guitar. And then we recorded one record. We recorded our first 7-inch at Howie's place, that Sound on Sound, in his basement. Like I think the drum room was in the laundry room. It was all sectioned off, pretty funny. But Todd's name's on the record, but he, for some reason, he didn't join us until after that record came on. But that was fun, just to record a record, like, and that thing is 30 years old.
How do you distinguish Solution Unknown from Maurice?
Solution Unknown was just a fun band. Just kind of, it was kind of like a joke band in a way, but it was just fun to sit there and just play hardcore. And because when I look at our playing schedule, I kept track of all that, and I kept track of all the Maurice shows, and a lot of them were like overlapped. It'd be Maurice one weekend and Solution Unknown. It's like Solution Unknown ended up almost being like one of the house bands at Charlie's.
Okay.
With the Uninvited. Which that was, another interesting chapter to the scene was Charlie's Pizzeria.
Well, yeah, talk about that. I was going to ask you about that.
And I don't know how that started, where, you know, it seems like all of a sudden it was there and then punk bands playing there. Maybe it was Wayne working there or Chris Abramovich working there. But,
let's set it physically in sort of the neighborhood.
Because it was the corner of Highland Avenue and Bardstown.
Right.
I think it's some Mediterranean place now, or no.
Yeah. It's a Middle Eastern place. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
But it was next door to that, and it's now part of the kitchen for Jack Fry's. And it was never like a huge crowd there, but it was a punk rock version of Cheers, I guess, because it was always the same people in there. And then when there were shows, I mean, of course, more people would show up. But there's Finko there, Steve Simpson, Wayne, just all the regulars. I think all the Endpoint kids would hang out there. I've got a few shows. I think I've got a few videos from that place, too. That's where, I guess, the scene was getting a little more of its identity. Like, you had the straight-edge kids, and you had these hardcore kids, and then you had the artsy kids, and then you had the metal punk kids. That was kind of cool. And there again, I don't think it was intentionally doing the factioning thing. It's just what people liked. And there was the interesting sense of scene unity. You know, it's like this is our place, this is our world, this is. And I think most people were like open to having people come check it out. Who else was playing around back then? I don't know. Uninvited. Fading Out was playing.
Okay.
Well, the Bulls, right? 86?
Bulls did not. I mean, we were playing then. We never played at Charlie's.
Right, right, right.
It was, but yeah, it was that time period.
Violence of the Sun, which was Chris Abramovich's right. band. Spot played. Endpoint probably played.
Well, I guess the key thing that we haven't explicitly said is that it was all ages, because mm-hmm. it was a pizza place. It wasn't a bar like Tooligan's was.
And they did sell beer, but since it was a restaurant, you know, we could still get beer, even though we were underage. And the straight edge kids, you know, they wouldn't drink. I mean, everybody is pretty much pretty orderly. I mean, it got wild in there a few times. And back to the Solution Unknown thing. Yeah. John Toombs and I mean, he was kind of like me with, we collected a lot of records. And that Discord thing and the early Touch and Go, those labels, SST, all those early labels were so cool to me and fascinating. And so I'd always hunt those records down. And I'd actually found a few of these Discord records at Pyramid that are really rare now. And I don't even know if they knew what they were doing. It was just do it.
Right.
You know. I mean, I don't think anybody knew DIY back then. And so I thought, well, I'm going to try to do a record label because there's so much cool music in Louisville. And so I figured I'd name it after Brett's fanzine, Self-Destruct, because when he did that fanzine, he was always sitting there pushing and promoting Louisville punk and hardcore. I thought, well, that would be fitting for the label. And kind of modeling it off of the Discord model where it's local bands.
Right.
And, you know, had I had more money, but, you know, working at ERXC and St. Anthony's and this nursing home and Prospect, I mean, couldn't do that many records. But that Solution Unknown record was the first one. I think we did 300 of that. And then there were some friends of ours, had a band called Big Deal, and they're from the East End, and it was pretty much the same kind of Discord or DC influenced hardcore. And then the third record I did was the Louisville Sluggers, the very very first one. And I think Fading Out was on that, Spot was on that, put a Solution Unknown track, and I think and Big Deal. And that worked out really well, because I'm hoping to do number four here soon. And I didn't realize the records. I mean, I was going to end up putting out that many records. But there's so many good bands. Like Better Days started doing their records. They did Bush League. They did Indignant Few. And Scott Richer had Slam Deck. And there was always a little competition and stuff. Sure. In a way, but it wasn't like, you know, I didn't wish, I mean, I don't think anybody wanted to, we didn't talk shit about each other.
Right.
If you look at it, it's like all of us had X amount of money, and if it looks like we're putting out our friends, well, that's because we know our friends.
Right.
You know, and we like this music. Because I'm doing this band and I'm not doing your band doesn't mean I don't like your band. I'm not Bill Gates. I don't have that money. I mean, had I had that money, I would have been doing a lot more records. But with the Louisville Sluggers thing, I try to include everybody in terms of, if I don't have your band on here, I want the record stores, I want the record labels, I want whomever supports our little music community to give me something, and I'll put it in that record. And that worked out well, because like Louisville Sluggers 2 and 3, I mean, those were just stuffed full of ads for local businesses and labels. I don't know if you feel it, but you probably do, is that there's the Louisville music scene is a lot, to me, it's above a lot of other towns or cities our size. Mm-hmm. You know, that we had Babylon Dance Band, we had Squirrel Bait, and we got Slint. We got these bands that are like kind of groundbreaking, but it's some other cities don't have that kind of output that we did. And, you know, even now we've got My Morning Jacket. You know, people talk shit about that, and it's like, and I'm just happy we've got all these bands that come out of Louisville. I mean, what comes out of Nashville? You know, I mean, I don't know who, if there's, what's coming out of Nashville?
Jason and the Scorchers, I guess.
But seeing how long ago was that?
Yeah.
But like now,
yeah.
Who they have, I mean, we've got this unique thing, and I guess it might be, there's a unique experience here. I mean, everybody thinks, all, you know, one way or the other. It's a very liberal-minded thing in the Highlands. And maybe it's just that we've had such good music here that people, you know, strive. We've got things to strive for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, how many bands in town maybe got influenced by Squirrel Bait, Slint? I mean, the Slint thing. I mean, look at Crane. And those guys took it to another level.
Right.
And even like Parlor, and I wish I had a chance to go out and see more bands now.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's not the same experience for me when I was 15 and 16.
Right.
And I want to let these folks have their experience. I mean, I don't want to be really any kind of input on how they deal with their music community now. With the exception, of course, you know, I'm inserting, you know, the Richie White record, American Legions record, and we get that Malignant Growth record, and then that Louisville Sluggers 4, whenever I get that one done.
Yeah.
But for these kids to have their experience of I went to this show, and I remember this show, I don't know if I was their age having me tell them, like, you can't do that. You can't do that. You got to do this.
Right.
I'd be like, get away from me, old man. And just let them grow organically. I mean, that's just like so many thoughts.
Yeah. Well, so, yeah, I mean, I think it is, well, a couple things. I mean, you've said a lot about it, but I mean, why do you think that Louisville is a different place? How do you think it's different either from national scene or other local scenes?
It seems to me that even though we do have some national acts that come out of Louisville, it seems like the bands are huge for the city rather than them being huge for the rest of the country.
Right.
Just the different styles of music of everybody kind of being a step ahead of everybody else. And not intentionally, like, we're going to do this to be different from somebody else. But, like, Freakwater and Will Oldham doing their kind of thing. And how many people have they influenced in town?
Right.
There's Like with King Horse, would us being together now still, I mean, be worth anything? I mean, it's run its course, and most of those people that saw us back then are probably in their 30s, early 40s.
Right.
Attorneys, doctors, teachers, whatever, you know. I don't think they're thinking like, I'm going to do some stage dives and all this stuff. We've got kids. I mean, I don't have kids. I might stage dive. I don't know. I don't know. Everybody's got the... I don't know what the experience is here. I think it's just the influence of... we've got a very artistic town, you know? Even outside of the music.
Yeah.
And that's what's kind of sad about the Highlands when I look at the Highlands now. Because it is just, it's not the way it was in the 80s. It's so mainstream now. And it's people are getting boxed in. And nobody's, I mean, the people that get outside the box, I mean, they stand out. But it's still like, it was crazy free thinking in the Highlands.
Right.
I mean, there's weirdos and beatniks and just walking up and down the street and burnouts and drunks and then nerds and
Right. Yeah. Cheap rent does a lot.
Yeah. And now it's all going sky high. It's like, that's why we're out here in the creek, because it's like, I've had my experience there and I don't need to relive it. Like, continue living it, because that was a great chapter for me.
Right.
I mean, it's like years of a chapter, but in those years, there's so many little mini chapters that have gotten me where I am now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And when I think I'm pretty lucky to have the experiences I've had, you know, because I think it's probably a very unique experience. And that goes back to, and I just get into things that, not to get in trouble, but just to see, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, so chronologically, we were just getting to King Horse.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I forget, King Horse, that, okay, we had broken up, Maurice had broken up, and I think Solution Unknown, we were still playing around. Just had, you know, Todd may have been getting ready to go to college. And I think Britt and Dave and started messing around. And then they found Ethan. I think I remember being down at JCC. And I think Sean was going there for some classes too, and maybe we hadn't played in a while or done anything. It was just that there was a little lull. I mean, I was still playing that Solution Unknown thing, but just the realization of when Maurice broke up that Britt and Dave had a direction. They didn't know what direction it was, but they were strongly minded into going that direction.
Right.
And I think Sean and I knew, man, Black Sabbath on speed. I mean, that's, we're into this hammering these people and just, and so I forget who we had on drums first. Might have been this guy, Bill Heideman. I think he played drum for Dot 39, which was John Hawkins, and I forget who else was in that band. And then the first guitar player we tried out was Alex Durg.
So, yeah, Mark mentioned that when I talked to him. I didn't realize that.
That's... Yeah, and, you know, he's a great player, but it didn't work out because, I mean, for me, it was a different kind of rock and roll kind of thing. Kind of, his guitar style was different from what I was thinking in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And
how so?
Because I was thinking Mark Abramovich the whole time. You know? Especially, you know, the fading out. I mean, and just all the riffs that he wrote. I mean, it was... I mean, he's like the riff master in Louisville to me. You know, he's always had the hooks. And so when we all realized, and I think Alex and Sean and I, it just didn't work out. No hard feelings for anybody. And I forget how we got Mark, but I just remember going up to Mark's place on Bardstown Road, and he had some kind of lick. And that sounds cool. And it ended up being, what song was it? Maybe Awaken? I don't know. I don't know what the first, what song it was, but it's exactly what we were wanting. I think all of us. And then I forget, how Kevin got in the picture. And I could be wrong, but I think he had heard Solution Unknown had gone to DC to record. I mean, that's how gung-ho we were about DC and all that stuff and Dag Nasty. And we'd record an album at Inner Ear Studios in DC, where Minor Threat and all those guys recorded. And I think maybe Kevin heard that, because I'd written a couple songs on there, and maybe he watched us when we played with Fading Out at Swiss Hall. We played before them. And I think maybe he called me up and wanted to do a band. Like I said, I could be wrong. I have the memory wrong. But either way, he got in. And so it was Sean, Mark, me, and Kevin. And at that point, it was almost like when I joined Maurice with Pajo. You know, Sean, Britt, Dave, and me. It had that same kind of magic where it was just like a punch in the face. And so, you know, and I don't know, maybe Sean and I would just sit there and kind of egg each other on of like, we got to kill everybody, you know. Fuck everybody up. We gotta see this, you know, and which we probably did, and that was great back then. I mean, for those shows that we did, and of course, you know, that band ran its course.
Okay,
we got to looking back. The touring was fun. I mean, it was all hazy for me. I mean, I was probably just drinking beer all the time. And, cause if I didn't look at our tour itinerary, I wouldn't even know what place we played. But it was just cool to be out on the road. I remember one time we played in Florida, and so I brought my boogie board, and those guys were like, fuck you, you ain't gonna go out there on the beach. And I'm like, I'm the one driving most of the time. So, We played in San Antonio, and we had a day off to get to Florida. And I was like, hey, guys, let's go to New Orleans. And they're like, fuck that place, blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, in the back of my mind, it's like, I'm driving. And so I took the exit to New Orleans. I was like, oh, shit. You know, so we get to New Orleans, and I kind of remember, like, them being shitty, you know. But it's like, well, we're already here, so we start drinking a bunch of Hurricanes and Gert Bucket. Dirk Gasky was with us, because he's always with us. He's a side guy and stuff. So, and I don't know how much we had to drink, but somehow we left there and ended up in Florida on the beach. And, we got to the beach, and this was kind of a weird thing. and it was a hard thing to visualize, but Dirk jumps out of the van and he starts stripping off his clothes and runs out in the water. I may have had my clothes on and just jumped out in the water because I think I kept the same clothes on the whole time, just didn't change or nothing, just dirty. But he got back to the van and he had some towel, and it was just like the way he was using that towel, like flossing his groin, and we were all just like, ugh. And then we played a couple shows, and this may have been two different times we went to Florida, I don't know. But when I had that boogie board, we got a hotel room in Daytona, because I think I did the same thing. I was like, let's go to the beach. Fuck the beach. Like, fuck you and your boogie board. We ain't going to the beach. But, of course, we went up to the beach. So I think they're probably cursing my name up in the hotel room. I'm like, I don't give a shit. Now I'm out there riding the waves, and then one by one they come down, and Mark's all, give me that. And he's out there trying to ride the waves with his blue hat. I didn't get that thing back. And it's like, you sons of bitches, you know, you hated that. You know, you didn't want to go here. And Mark's out there riding, and then one time he got hit by some big wave, and he gets out of the water, didn't have the hat on. So we scramble, we're trying to find a blue hat. We found it for him. A very unpunk rock hat. He'd always wear that hat, a blue fisherman's hat.
Well, that's funny.
Yeah, because on that King Horse thing, we were doing a lot of pranks then, but he was sitting in the lobby of the hotel, and Kevin called down there and was paging for him. It's like, can you get that guy Skipper? He's sitting in the lobby with a blue hat. And you can hear it like, Skip, right, Skipper, Skipper, Skip. And he got on the phone. He's like, you motherfuckers.
Well, so my recollection is that King Horse had some of the biggest crowds that any Louisville alternative or whatever you want to call it band saw.
And I think at that time, it's timing, too. Mm-hmm. Because all those little factions around during Maurice and like, the early Endpoint, Death Watch, and then you had the other punk rock kids, they're getting more people in their crowds. You know, more their friends. And the friend base started growing. So, you know, around that time, I guess when there was a punk rock show, everybody punk rock would show up. And, I mean, because it was crazy how big the crowds got. And then, even then, like, beyond that, like, Endpoint would get these crazy crowds. Something we wouldn't think of, like when Squirrel Bait would play, or when Maurice would play. And it was just a difference of, like, 2-3 years. And then it exploded. And I think people started feeling a little more safe and secure about, hey, I'm going to be this way. I'm not going to be... They want to be rebellious. They're a lot of people hit their rebellious time at the same time, I guess.
Uh-huh.
You know? And like they all did it together, which was cool. And I think we were kind of on the edge of, you know, getting out of that and just watching it and just giving them a soundtrack to be wild and crazy.
Yeah, it's a good band for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I don't know what happened toward that. We had recorded the album. Totally didn't sound like what we wanted it to sound. It sounded like Danzig Jr. But it was just cool to have somebody else pay for the record. Yeah. And it was cool for the experience. Somebody else flying us up to New York, flying us to L.A. to have Danzig produce it. It's those little experiences that other people don't get to experience. So, you know, no matter how much we joke about Danzig, it's still just like you're part of his little world at some point. And I mean, I'm sure I get along with Danzig now, but at that time, because we were just such smartasses, and I think when we were recording, Roy Orbison died.
Ah.
And so I asked him, I said, hey, Glenn, since Roy's dead, does that mean you're going to be the new Traveling Wilbury? And so I think that's where, if you listen to King Horse record, you can barely hear the bass. So I think that's probably where that came from. I mean, maybe the bass playing wasn't that great. I don't know. But he was pretty pissed off about that and didn't talk to me after that. But I thought it was a great line.
Really?
Yeah. Fuck you, man. Roy was a great guy. Because they wrote that song Lesson Zero together. Or they wrote a song together or something.
I didn't realize that.
Because yeah. They did that Lesson Zero soundtrack.
Okay.
So that's why I said that. I was like, so, you going to be the new Traveling Wilbury?
Oh, man. So you didn't feel like the record really sounded like you guys?
No. I mean, it would have been hard capture. I would have loved to have heard like a wall of guitars. And then let Kevin cut loose on the drums, too. And then let Rat just scream his way through the whole thing, you know, because it seemed to me like Danzig was on his first LP came out, the first Danzig record came out, and it was just this subdued, stripped down Rick Rubin produced thing, and so I guess he was trying to do that to us, and I still like our other demos better than the record, but I mean, people love that record.
Yeah,
and I've, you know, it's just, I heard it differently.
Right.
And, but I'm, like I said, I'm glad we have the record. And even finding a Japanese version of the CD was kind of cool. You know?
Oh, that is cool, yeah.
And we might take things for granted, but there's kids, or they're not kids anymore. It's like, I was in Indianapolis, and some guy was like, I went to go see Tears for Fears. This guy was up there. He brought his daughter to go see them. And she had some old Tears for Fears shirt that he'd gotten. And he said, you Mike Bacayu? And I was like, yeah. He's like, man, you're in King Horse, man. He says, because he's 40-something years old. He said, I was just listening to you all a few days ago. He says, I listen to your all's record when I work out. It's like, how random.
Yeah.
He's like, look, it's even on my phone. I told you. I thought, well, that's kind of cool. I mean, that happens every now and then. And of course, I appreciate that. I mean, because I was on the other side and, you know, being a cocky son of a bitch back then. But I guess it added more to their experience of, you know, they wouldn't want some dude Bacayu playing on stage like, hi, guys.
Right.
I'm a part of your life. And also, I think at that time, like, when King Horse, I don't even know that we actually said we're splitting up. But I probably just gave the impression that I'm done. I mean, because I kind of was. I think I was living in excess at that point, too. And my brain was just, I mean, I think I was fighting a bunch, drinking a bunch, doing everything. And I was like, I'm going to end up being one of these burnouts on Bardstown Road. And not that I was tiring of the people. It was probably more tiring of what I was doing. And that's when I had my little sabbatical and just left town. And
no, I didn't realize that. Where'd you go?
Well, I mean, it was just a short little trip.
Oh, I see.
Because, I mean, I was drinking a lot and doing probably who knows what and going nowhere. And it was always the same people I was around, the Highlands. All those, you know, it was the same crowd. And so when I went out west, and I'm sure a lot of people do this little sabbatical, probably do the same route I did, but got to Yellowstone and stood on top of the tallest mountain in there. I wanted to strip off my clothes and just, you know, beat it. I mean, because I'm looking around 100 miles all the way around And it was free, except for the guys to get there. And I thought, my world is bigger than the Highlands. Even though that's where my world was so much because playing music. But I was like, this world is too huge for me to sit there. And I think there's a lot of soap operas back home. And a lot of them probably me making some soap operas too. And so it took me a while to kind of detach myself. And that's where I pulled the plug on everything.
Uh-huh.
It's like no more electricity. And that's when I started going to those bluegrass festivals. And everybody I met there, I had that same feeling of excitement from when I first heard new wave and punk. And, you know, hearing the Stanley Brothers. And just like, I gotta have every Stanley Brother record. I gotta get every Bill Monroe record. And then I started digging deep and disappeared into that for like 20 years. Mm-hmm. I actually was into bluegrass longer than I was in punk rock.
All right.
You know? And then now, you know, coming full circle, a lot of my bluegrass, you know, heroes are not here anymore.
Right.
And I started going to shows a few years ago. Saw Juanita, and I don't think I may have seen them back in the early 90s or something. I don't remember, because a lot of that's so cloudy. And I saw Richie White, and I just got excited again seeing local bands. And then, I mean, I saw a few others, and then, and reconnecting with everybody again was super cool, because it's like, there's some people that stayed the same, and then there's some people that, like, kind of evolved, but were the same people, but, like, accumulating more experience.
Right.
And that was really cool. And, like, seeing Rigaud was, you know, and hanging out with him and just not realizing, you know, that he was sick or anything, you know. Or he wasn't back then. And,
Talk about him. What?
He was, as long as I've known him, I mean, he was always just super nice, and we always talked about music, and always talked about, it's like, hi, Mike, how are you? And I remember working with him on the End Tables record, and I was like, it's got to be, telling him, it's got to be flamboyant. It's got to be something. It's got to be something that fits you, you know, and then also fit the music. And
this is the 7-inch.
The 7-inch, yeah. The one I did, and it's a White Glove Test and Trick or Treat, which I thought I'm very lucky that those didn't get on that first 7-inch, because I mean those two are my favorite tracks, and so there's another example of, well, that's a record I'd love to do. Let me just ask. All I can do is say no. And they were into it. So it's like, yes, got to do that. I went to go visit Rigaud a few times when he was in the hospital. And it was just, you know, it's just sad to see, you know, just knowing that, you know, he was going to have that struggle and it wasn't going to end up good. But in the years of being in this scene, our Louisville underground scene, every year it seems to me like there's 2, 3, 4 people that pass away. And whether by suicide or drug overdose. And so after a certain point, it's not that I'm not sad. It's kind of numbing and expected. And you know, I hate to lose anybody. I hate to see anybody in our scene, you know, pass away. But it's... I was talking to my wife. I said, I don't think that's normal for people to know that many people in a span of years that die.
It's going to get more frequent, Mike.
Yeah, but in our circle, it's like... Yeah. Because we have more people that do drugs or do, you know, the suicide thing. It's like, we've got a very emotional circle of friends. And so that's what I attribute it to. And I'm glad everybody was a part of my life. Or, you know, we can all be a part of that. It, when I talk about the sum of all experiences, it's just like all this stuff. Because Michelle says I'm a hoarder, calls me a hoarder about everything. Which, early on when I was getting the record label, I said I was trying to find everything that was local. When Steve Jan came up to ERXC, I'd always be like, man, do you have any End Tables records? And he told me, he's like, yeah, come on over to my apartment. And he lived over where, maybe Ditto's? One of those apartments right there. And so I went over there and he's like, you could have those right there. And he's using a stack of End Tables records to hold up a shelf. There's no sleeves. So I had, I mean, I had a stack of those End Tables records, which I think I probably gave away all of them. But trying to find that, trying to find all the Circle X records, just anything, you know, getting your food, that record. And that's kind of how I was trying to, not intentionally archiving Louisville music, but from that span of the early 80s till maybe 92, is I tried to buy everything local. And after a while, I was like, there's so much stuff, and I'm not that rich.
Yeah.
You know, because even me being close friends with Dave, he was putting out a lot of records. Will was putting out a lot of records. It's like, and it, also at that same time is when I was kind of like, well, sneaking over here, I'm out of here. You know, in that whole time period when I was gone, they put out so many records. Dave, Will,
whoever. You're saying Paho. They're both really prolific.
I mean, even Freakwater, and I mean, there's just records I don't have, and I just figured, well, somebody else collected all that stuff, I'll have my stamp on this. And you know, it's like, I wish I could have documented more. I've got physical things that I can say, look, we've got flyers, I've got notebooks, but you never think, well, this is what I was doing that day, or this is what was going on. Because I've actually been keeping a journal, not like a diary, but a journal for the past 14 years. So I can look back 14 years and pick out a date and say, all right, this happened, I did this, did this. And, I mean, it's all up and down. And it's cool. I don't know, I think collecting... the music things in Louisville, like, I'm glad we did the White Glove test book, because that should have been documented. And I'm glad I've got all those old 78s of those old country people. Right, right. You know, and I wish I had more. And it, just having as many music people from this town, and to be a part of it. You know, I might have a little blip here, I guess, and that's fine. It's kind of cool.
So are you playing the Richie White Orchestra, right?
Yeah, I played. We put out their record, and then their bass player took a little hiatus, so they asked me to play, and I thought, man, I hadn't been on the stage in years, and I had a blast playing with them. I mean, totally different from anything I'd ever played before, because it was, you know, playing King Horse, playing Maurice, Switch Unknown. And this was more kind of catchy pop kind of, you know. It was an interesting experience. But, you know, getting to play out in California, we went out there, flew out there, which was expensive. It was a long story about that, where it's basically like we all had to pay to play out there. And I'd take off a few days from work, and then difficult and challenging to explain to the wife, like, hey, I'm going out with this band. We're going to play in L.A. and San Francisco. Is that okay? Right. Without me? But we did get to play, you know, when we got back, we got to play with Sean Lennon's band.
Oh.
Which Caesar said he had requested us, which, hell, that's cool. And there were some people after we played that show, they're like, I think we sold out of the records we had there. I'm thinking, cool, because we were spot on that night. And then we played with Lydia Lunch. Yeah, the first time I got back on stage for a show like that was that Rigaud benefit.
Okay.
And I think I screwed up a song there, but I mean, it had been years of before that I'd been on stage and having to go to band practice. I'd have to leave work and then go to the practice space at 11 mm-hmm. at night. It's like, oh, it's rough.
Really?
And then, so playing in a band now, is out of question for me. I mean, I never say never, but I'd be the third wheel on there. Like, right. You know, because if these guys really want to do a band, I've got so much stuff going on that's, you know, I've already... It's the been there, done that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. We've been talking an hour and a half.
It's good I don't have any beer here.
Right. Oh, man. Okay. So, what are the important things that we didn't talk about that you think people should know about?
I don't know. I think the question is right. I think everybody's going to have their own unique experience with doing this. And like we talked about before, like it can stem from what part of town you grew up in and your upbringing. And then how you got exposed to this music. For me, I was always, I guess I'm just an adventurous person of trying, wanting to experience different things. And like I said, pretty much my whole life, growing up the way I did and moving around when I was younger, we kind of had to be on our own. Moving from the naval base apartment complex to living out in the country outside of Pottstown. Mm-hmm. I mean, where it was just, we were way out in the sticks and had a few neighbors, but basically we just ran around out in the woods.
Yeah.
That's where I got my love of the outdoors too. And then moving here where my mom had always been. Growing up, she would always tell us, you all are Filipino. You're born here in the United States, but you're born Filipino. You look Filipino. People are always going to look at you. And so if you do bad, then you're making all of us look bad. And she said, you let those people know. And she didn't really mean it like this, but you show them that you're better than they are.
mm-hmm.
And I think she was meaning that, for me, I took it as, I just need to blend in, because when we were in Philadelphia, there's black kids, there's Chinese kids, we were just kids.
Right.
And so that's way, kind of when we got here, I blame my not eating seafood on that. That, moving here, I'm not going to bring shrimp and fish to school lunch because everybody else is eating bologna sandwiches. I want bologna sandwich. I want to be just like those kids. I don't want to stick out being all weird stuff. And then what I learned too is people do look at me because I'm Filipino. And in a way, I've somewhat benefited because, let's say, like me going to bluegrass festivals. When I first started going to bluegrass festivals, when they realized I wasn't Japanese, I would get quizzed on, what do I know about bluegrass? Can you play bluegrass? And then I would have to somehow turn it around like, I'm playing this, can you play? Yeah. And did you know about this Stanley Brothers song? Did you know this about the Stanley Brothers? Did you know this about Ralph and the connection of this? And so, and that, you know, we all save face and we all became good buddies. And then also at the festivals, so that they end up remembering the Filipino guy at the festival. And so, right. And some of them, I was known as the Philbilly.
Oh, that's great.
You know, which was awesome. Yeah. And like when Alison Krauss would play here, it's like they knew me. It's like, there he is. I mean, because I'd chase after her a little bit. I mean, not chase after, right. But kind of. Yeah. Okay. And of course, sure. Before I'm married.
Right, of course.
But the guys in the band knew me, which was flattering. Right. Like, they'd always remember. And a lot of the big-wig bluegrass guys would always remember me. And I'd be able to talk to them. And they remembered my skin color and the way I looked, but it wasn't about that, ultimately. It's like, oh, yeah, yeah. Because we always recognize people. When we look at people, it's like, oh, yeah, you're that person because, you know, aside from your face, you have this. And
right.
Distinguishable marks.
Right.
So, but yeah, again, everybody's got a unique experience, and it'd be interesting to hear other people. Yeah. And hopefully some of my memories parallel other people's memory. And hopefully it wasn't part of that haze that I was in, because, and I'm sure everybody's going to have that problem where they can, that the hazy parts, but if we had a long time, we can expand on things, you know.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned your parents, and I guess that's one thing I was thinking about. How did you, the last time you mentioned your parents in the story, you'd moved out, and they were saying they're cutting you off except for paying for your schooling. But I know I see you know, pictures with your dad and stuff. How did you mend it with them?
I think they realized that coming from the Philippines, in the Philippines, the children are extremely respectful. And I wasn't what they were expecting.
Okay, sure.
Because, you know, my contact with all the other kids my age. And they didn't make me bad. They didn't make me rebellious.
But, right.
I think they realized, well, you just do what you want then. You know so much. You know, mm-hmm. We love you, blah, 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 blah. And I forget what, after all that stuff, after the band started, you know, getting some sort of notoriety or getting some sort of success mm-hmm. with the music, right. Then it kind of like, we got to be friends and all that. I mean, it's not that we were never friends.
Right.
They just said, all right, you go do that stuff. And then they're saying that, well, he's been doing it. He's getting it. Good. He scared the shit out of us or whatever.
Right.
But I after a certain point, I always talk to my folks. I mean, and like in the past 15, 20 years, I've called my folks every day. And I still, you know, call my dad every day. And I hear people like, I wish I would have done this. And I don't want to have that moment.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then when I look at my dad, another huge influence, well, both my parents, that they came over here, it's like them jumping into the unknown.
Right.
You know? And they pulled it off.
Yeah.
And I think that's where I got it from. Some of that wayward soul thing is from my dad, because he loves to travel and always has loved to travel. And he's got a wealth of experiences from, you know, all his travels. And so I'm just racking up my own.
Okay. That's a nice place to stop. I think we'll do that.